Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Arizona Supreme Court upholds a Civil War-era abortion law, effectively banning the procedure in the state.
Congressman Mike Johnson fights to remain as House Speaker among a divided Republican Party.
And reconciliation and rebuilding in Rwanda, 30 years after the genocide that killed more than a million people.
We decided to forgive and we decided to move on, but that thing still lingers. It's a human, natural thing.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Arizona will soon be the latest state with a near-total abortion ban after that state's Supreme Court revived a 160-year-old law. The law provides no exceptions for rape or incest. And in its 4-2 opinion, the conservative majority wrote, quote, "Physicians are now on notice that all abortions, except those necessary to save a woman's life, are illegal."
Doctors who perform abortions could face criminal prosecution and prison time, though the Democratic Attorney General says she will not prosecute. It's the latest test of the limits on abortion since the Supreme Court ended federal abortion protections from the decades-old Roe v. Wade decision. And in this election year, there's already an effort underway to get a pro-abortion rights amendment on Arizona's ballot in November. Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs responded to today's court decision.
Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state. As governor, I promised I would do everything in my power to protect our reproductive freedoms.
Carter Sherman covers reproductive health for The Guardian and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Arizona State Supreme Court lifted a stay on this 1864 law that was passed before Arizona was a state. Help us understand how they arrived at this decision.
So this ban has been the source of court battles and chaos since the overturning of Roe almost 2 years ago. What happened is, after a very long period of litigation, the Supreme Court of Arizona decided today that since there is no more Roe v. Wade, there is no reason why this 1864 ban should not go into effect. Now, what's unclear at this point is when exactly that ban will fully take effect and be enforceable in the words of the court. Abortion providers and their supporters are at this time really trying to figure out what this decision means for all the people on the ground in Arizona.
How is it that this Civil War era law supersedes the previous law that the legislature passed and the previous governor signed in 2022 that made abortion accessible up to 15 weeks?
When the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion nationwide in Roe v. Wade in 1973, that meant that there were several laws across the country that dated back decades that were no longer going to be in effect. And many of these laws were never really truly dealt with. They just went dormant. And so when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe in 2022, suddenly all of these states, including Arizona, had to deal with these so-called zombie laws that they had not ever really fully reckoned with. Arizona had also, in 2022, passed a separate 15-week abortion ban. But what happened was that 15-week abortion ban and this near-total abortion ban from 1864 just sort of coexisted, and they weren't really harmonized in any kind of way. In this case in particular, Planned Parenthood has argued that these laws needed to be harmonized, and that's why that the 15-week ban should be allowed to stand over the 1864 ban. That's not the argument that the Arizona Supreme Court accepted today.
Well, in the meantime, Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays says she will not prosecute any doctor who performs abortion procedures. Mays says that this is a collective effort with the state's governor. How is that being received by county prosecutors who could potentially use their own discretion?
I think that there are many, many questions about what it really means for an official like Mays to say that she will try to hold off on any kind of prosecutions of abortion providers. The providers that I've talked to and I've heard from don't necessarily feel like they are totally in the clear at this point, and they are confused about what it means moving forward if they were to provide abortions.
What's the expected impact on women's health care in Arizona and in the surrounding region?
Arizona has been a critical release valve for places like Texas, which have a total abortion ban on the books right now. So if we ban abortion totally or almost totally in Arizona, there's going to be plenty of people throughout the Southwest who previously might have fled to Arizona for abortions who will now have to travel even farther out. Abortion rights supporters also say that this could have massive impacts on things like maternal mortality. So there's going to be really wide-ranging effects really across the region in a variety of health areas.
And there's also the political impact. Arizona, as you well know, is among a handful of key battleground states. An effort is already underway right now to put a measure on the 2024 ballot that would enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution. How might this affect not just the presidential election, but that key Senate race, that hotly contested Senate race in Arizona?
I think that this decision today is going to make Arizona one of the biggest battlefields, particularly in abortion, but also in the presidential race, also in the Senate race, in the 2024 elections. What we're looking at here is a potentially very galvanized population outraged by the overturning of Roe, outraged by a near total abortion ban, and those people might decide to go to the polls en masse and vote not just for abortion rights, but also for Democrats. There's actually been, since the decision came out today, many Republicans in the state saying, you know, this was a bad idea. I don't support this decision. And some of them have said that they will work to try to figure out a way back to this 15-week abortion limit and not the near total abortion ban. I've covered this issue for many years. I've covered it long before Roe was overturned, and I have never really seen this sort of immediate 180 from Republicans in this way on this issue.
That is Carter Sherman with The Guardian. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting and your insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
In the day's other headlines, the Environmental Protection Agency is cracking down on pollution from some 200 chemical plants from Texas to the Ohio River Valley. Administrator Michael Regan said the new regulations offer, quote, strong final standards to slash pollution, reduce cancer risk, and ensure cleaner air for nearby communities. Also today, an appeals court upheld the EPA's decision to allow California to set its own tailpipe emissions limits and electric vehicle requirements. Europe's highest human rights court ruled today that the Swiss government has not done enough to protect its citizens from climate change. Experts say it's the first ruling of its kind. A group of 2,000 elderly Swiss women brought the case. The landmark ruling was read in a packed court in France. One of the Swiss plaintiffs reacted afterward.
Senior Women for Climate brought climate and fundamental rights to court for the first time. And the court recognized our fundamental right to a healthy climate and to have our country do what it failed to do until now, to take ambitious measures to protect our health and future.
The court rejected two other climate cases on procedural grounds. That all follows the EU Climate Agency announcing that last month was the hottest March on record. Rail operator Norfolk Southern has agreed to a $600 million settlement for last year's train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. The train caught fire and released more than 1 million gallons of hazardous material. Residents within 20 miles of the crash who suffered, quote, potential adverse impacts are eligible for compensation. The parents of the teenager who killed four of his Michigan schoolmates in 2021 have been sentenced to up to 15 years in prison. Jennifer and James Crumbly were convicted of involuntary manslaughter for failing to prevent their son's actions. They are the first parents in the U.S. to be convicted over deaths caused by a child in a mass shooting. Their son is serving life in prison without parole. Hamas says it's reviewing the latest Israeli ceasefire proposal delivered by Egyptian and Qatari mediators at talks in Cairo. It would include a six-week pause in fighting and a swap of 40 Israeli hostages for 700 Palestinian prisoners. Speaking to military recruits today, Israel's prime minister doubled down on his pledge to eliminate Hamas forces in southern Gaza.
We will complete the elimination of Hamas brigades, including in Rafah. There is no force in the world that will stop us. Many are trying to do so, but it will not help, since this enemy, after what it did, will never do it again.
Meanwhile, Israel says 468 aid trucks entered Gaza today. That's the most since the war began. Gaza was also top of the agenda during a visit to Washington today by British Foreign Secretary David Cameron. Speaking at a joint press conference, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. had not received a date for a full-scale invasion of Rafah, but expects to meet with the Israelis next week.
How Israel conducts any further operations in Gaza matters a great deal. And as we've said, we're talking to them about alternative and, in our judgment, effective ways at solving a problem that needs to be solved, but doing it in a way that does not endanger the innocent.
Blinken and Cameron also both addressed the need for Congress to take action on military aid for Ukraine. That comes as Ukraine says it struck a Russian aviation factory in the Voronezh region, just across Ukraine's eastern border. Security video showed an explosion in Borisoglebsk. Russia says its forces shot down two drones. Ukraine has stepped up drone attacks on Russian soil to target the country's military infrastructure. Back in this country, former President Donald Trump has suffered a second defeat in as many days over his bid to delay his hush money trial. A New York appeals court judge rejected his request to stall the proceedings as he fights a gag order. Trump pleaded not guilty last year to 34 counts of falsifying business records related to payments to an adult film star. Jury selection is set to begin next week. On Wall Street today, stocks were little changed for a second day this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 38,883. The Nasdaq gained 52 points, and the S&P 500 added 7.5 points. And the college basketball season ended last night with the University of Connecticut claiming the men's championship for a second year running. Tristan Newton scored 20 points for the Huskies, who cruised to victory over Purdue 75-60. Some 14.8 million people tuned in to the game last night. That actually lagged behind the viewership for Sunday's women's final, which drew nearly 19 million viewers. Just saying. Still to come on the NewsHour, U.S. Ambassador to Japan Rahm Emanuel on this week's state visit by the Japanese Prime Minister. A new series exposes abusive behavior behind the scenes of some popular children's shows. A vital Appalachian cultural hub continues its long recovery after devastating floods, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Congress arrived back in Washington today with a long list of priorities for Speaker Mike Johnson to accomplish and a razor-thin margin to get it done. Our Lisa Desjardins has this report.
It's been a cold spring in Washington. Beautiful, but for the House of Representatives, delicate and uncertain, with echoing sounds that are the most daunting yet for the new House Speaker.
I will not tolerate a Speaker of the House that I voted for to sell us out.
Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene in a town hall in Tunnel Hill, Georgia last night again made it clear she wants Mike Johnson out.
I will not tolerate this anymore.
Greene has filed a potent bill, just one sentence, declaring the speakership to be vacant. In other words, removing Johnson. She's not yet forcing a vote, but it's a threat.
The bill is passed.
One issued last month after she and scores of Republicans broke with Johnson over the compromise deal to keep government funded.
That is not the way to do business.
Beyond spending, Johnson has other dilemmas. There's the border. Conservatives decry a lack of progress, though nothing can pass both chambers right now. There's FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Key powers are expiring next week, and Republicans are divided. Then there's Ukraine and Israel, with increasing calls for conditions on Israel aid. And if Johnson proposes Ukraine funding, he risks direct fire from a large group in opposition.
He's really kind of standing at the dike trying to plug holes right now. So I have tremendous sympathy for my good friend Mike Johnson.
John Fleming's now the treasurer of Louisiana, but over a decade ago, he was part of the Tea Party movement and a founder of the Freedom Caucus. He defends the sharp motion to vacate.
I think Democrats, to their credit, they fight hard, even when they're underdogs, even when they're in the minority. They fight hard for their policies. I can't say that about Republicans. Republicans oftentimes give in way too quickly.
But the problem for Johnson is that he has some members who want to fight, but he has a bare majority. He doesn't have room to maneuver, well, nor does he have good troop morale.
We live in a time of divided government. Democracy is messy. Sometimes it's very messy. This is part of that process. And we're going to keep steady hands at the wheel.
Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene do not want steady. They want their way. And she's using the tight margin in the House right now to try and get it. In just over a week, that vote gets even one vote tighter. That means to pass nearly anything, including Ukraine funding, it must be bipartisan. However, if Johnson pushes bipartisan bills, it would take just two or three Republicans to take away the majority from him as Speaker. Democrats could help him survive with their votes, but that would spark another major problem.
I think it's a really, really untenable spot to be put in, to be propped up by the opposition.
Eric Cantor is a former House Majority Leader who lost to a Freedom Caucus opponent. He says if Johnson survives, thanks to votes from leader Hakeem Jeffries and other Democrats, that would undermine Republicans running in primaries across the country. Cantor also sees the problem Johnson faces against all-or-nothing tactics from within the party.
I think that's really important, to never, ever sit here and just throw your hands up and say, we're going to be part of a destruction caucus and never get anything done.
You use the phrase destruction caucus.
For some, there is, and they've been quoted as such, saying nothing that Washington does is good. And I sort of question to myself, how is it that you want to be elected and serve in Washington if you say it's all bad?
For Speaker Johnson, who may control the fate of Ukraine aid, FISA reauthorization, and most any issue in Congress at the moment, the question is, can he find a way to get anything done and also survive? For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
This month, Rwanda is holding observances to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the genocide in that East African nation, a 100-day killing spree that took 1 million lives. Rwanda has won praise for its rebuilding efforts, but democratic backsliding and conflict just outside Rwanda's borders have raised concerns over the country's future stability and fear among survivors of the genocide. Fred DeSam Lazaro has our report, and a caution, the story includes language and images of extreme violence.
The memories from 30 years ago, it seems, will never become distant in Rwanda. The horrors lurking just below the surface, in some places literally. Theodat Seboyentore brought me to this plot of land in Ngoma, about 3 hours from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. It's yet another saturated crime scene from which volunteers began removing human remains late last year. They're not done.
Here there's a heavy roadblock.
So there was a roadblock just here.
Yeah.
And people were slaughtered and buried here.
Exactly.
He belongs to a local group of survivors of what's officially called the genocide against the Tutsi.
The survivors group estimates that in just the last 5 years, up to 100,000 remains have been uncovered in mass graves. This one in Ngoma is among the more recent. The body count here, about 1,000 and counting.
Like others in the group, Seboyentore, 14 at the time, somehow managed to evade the murderous mobs, along with one sister. But amid the panicked, terrified crowds, they were separated from their parents and five other siblings, none of whom survived.
Have you been able to discover where they were buried?
Not.
I'm sorry. I can never fathom what you went through. How do you keep from being angry?
Because in Rwanda we have rules.
Rules?
Rules. So we can't, and that is the spirit from our president.
President Paul Kagame, he says, has exhorted Rwandans to look forward, not back. Kagame looms large over every aspect of Rwandan life. In 1994, he led a force of exiles called the Rwandan Patriotic Front, or RPF, that defeated the genocidal regime, driving perpetrators from the rival Hutu tribe across the border into what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. Hutus and Tutsis share the same culture, but under Belgian colonial rule, the wealthier Tutsis received preferential treatment in education and jobs. This 14% minority elite grew to be resented, and after independence in 1962 brought a Hutu-dominated government, many Tutsis, including Kagame's family, fled into exile. Years of periodic upheaval ensued. Then in 1994, amid peace talks, a plane crash killed the country's Hutu president, and hell came to Rwanda.
You had a civil war and you had a genocide which devastated the country. The RPF leadership took over. They had a vision and they have implemented that vision.
University of California professor Scott Strauss has written extensively about Rwanda.
Much of that is amazing. Let's lead people to change the way they think about who they are. They should invest in development. They should forget about Hutu and Tutsi. They should think about themselves as Rwandan.
The RPF banned the designation of Hutu and Tutsi, instituting a combination of restorative justice and reconciliation efforts. Economic growth has been robust, and social welfare indicators have improved markedly in literacy, public health, and female participation in government and the economy.
I think the flip side for Kagame and for the leadership around Kagame is that effectively it's a dictatorship.
Kagame won praise globally for bringing stability and development to a desperate nation, but he has increasingly ruled with an iron hand.
You value national unity.
Amending the constitution to extend his tenure and cracking down hard on journalists and political opponents.
I mean, the critics are run out of town or in some cases assassinated. This is not a democracy story.
And Rwanda has been accused of stirring instability in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, its forces fighting exiled Hutu rebels and supporting the notorious M23 militia, which the U.S. government has condemned for atrocities including widespread rape and the murder of civilians.
The RPF and Kagame, they came to power through rebellion. By invading from Uganda. Their primary purpose is to secure the sort of zone around the country so that there could be no insurgency or rebellion that is going to invade from Congo or from a neighboring country that could destabilize Rwanda. At some point in time, there's going to be a transition in Rwanda. Historically, transitions in Rwanda have been very violent. I think the concern is that the resentment that we can't see right now will also be violent.
They're planning to come again and finish what they didn't finish in Rwanda, the genocide.
Among survivors living near the Ngoma mass grave, there's constant fear of the Hutu groups living next door in Congo, of perpetrators with unsettled scores.
We remember the genocide every single day, not only when we discover bodies, it's an everyday process.
The toxic part of it, the most toxic part of it, is that it continues for generations.
Amanda Akaliza, like most Rwandans today, was born after 1994, but she says they've inherited the post-traumatic stress with little guidance on how to deal with it.
If I look back right now, my college years, I felt like I was constantly outside of myself. Right, because I always felt on high alert. It's like a fire alarm, you know, going off in your system, but there's no fire.
Have you guys ever heard of social anxiety?
Having battled her own depression, she started an organization called Humeka to help young people grapple with their anxieties. There's stigma attached to mental health issues, so they connect through socially comfortable activities, like this basketball camp. The long shadow of 1994 is inescapable, Akaliza says.
If you go to the genocide memorial and you see just how graphic it was, the heaviness of seeing children dying, you know, that's the heaviness of seeing women being raped, your families being killed. We decided to forgive and we decided to move on, but that thing still lingers. It's a human, natural thing.
Everyone, it seems, is struggling to find closure. For survivors back in Ngoma, that can only come when more exiles return.
We have neighbors who have come back from Congo. We're living in harmony with no issue.
We deserve to have closure, and they deserve to have it for themselves.
They say it's the exiled genocide perpetrators who can help bring closure. They, more than anyone, can locate the graves of hundreds of thousands of victims who remain unaccounted for, their survivors hoping to find a piece of clothing or personal effect that might bring a positive ID. So far, Rwanda has reburied at least 400,000 victims at officially designated memorial sites across the country. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Ngoma, Rwanda.
Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is here in Washington, part of a state visit to the U.S., and a trilateral summit with the Philippines tomorrow. Japan is changing its defense posture, rearming in the face of a surging China. Ahead of tomorrow's presidential meetings, we're joined from the White House by the U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the NewsHour.
Jeff, thank you.
So among the many agenda items when these two leaders meet tomorrow is increased military cooperation, enabling military commanders from the U.S. and Japan to better work together. What's the practical impact of that, especially when it comes to containing China?
Well, I would actually not use the word containing. I would use the word deterring from doing something that would change the status quo. Second is the structure we have was actually established over the years since 1960. It's not appropriate for the future and the type of challenges we face today. Second is Japan has done a series of things and major changes. They went from 1% of their GDP towards the defense to 2%. They're acquiring counter-strike capability that didn't exist before. They're willing to start to export defense technology that they had prohibitions on before. And so the force structure change is to better integrate with the new joint command structure that they're setting up. Today, all our decisions have to go back to Honolulu. Putting it forward brings an integration and an effectiveness, and it brings a credibility to the deterrence that didn't exist before. And to me, it's more appropriate because the challenges we faced in the 1960s are not the challenges we face in 2024 and beyond. That is why it's a demarcation point.
We spoke with the Prime Minister on this program last week, and to your point, we've seen a real shift in that country's post-World War II pacifist stance. What is the U.S.'s expectation for how Japan would help the U.S. against China if China were to attack Taiwan, which is a real threat?
Well, I think the main thing, well, wait a second. You also have a state visit, and again, I would try to slightly look at a different way. Right now, this week started with something that hadn't happened before. The United States, Japan, Australia, and the Philippines did a joint naval exercise where you have a very small K kinetic effort by China to target, isolate the Philippines. We're putting together an alliance, multiple nations say this is not consequence free and the Philippines are not going to be isolated. It's China that's isolated. And if you ask me where the effort here, it's not, again, containment, it's deterrence and bringing credibility. At the end of this week, at the end of the state visit, you'll have a first ever historic trilateral meeting between the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Japan, and the President of the Philippines. That is also credibility on the diplomatic side, working with your defense preparation and credibility there, where the defense and diplomatic efforts bring one level of deterrence to China. And again, it isolates China, doesn't contain them, and makes it sure that there's a calculation and an understanding and appreciation of a consequence to the actions China takes. So what Japan's doing is what it used to do was think consequentially about Japan and its self-defense forces. We were an insurer of that from its own security, but it is now with the alliance. I think this era, the past was known as alliance protection. The era going forward is going to be alliance projection. And Japan's a full partner, whether you're dealing with trilateral relationships, whether you're dealing with a quad, whether you're dealing with development and economic assistance and economic integration with the Philippines or with Korea. This is the constant now is Japan going step by step, shoulder to shoulder with the United States on behalf of a view that we have rules and they are to be adhered to throughout the international system, and not the raw exercise of power, but rules and the rules of law that will be the modus operandi.
Well, as these two countries stand shoulder to shoulder, as you say, there is this point of contention over Nippon Steel. President Biden says he's opposed to the sale of U.S. steel to Japan-based Nippon Steel. He sees it as a economic and a national security issue. How do you see this matter resolving?
Well, look, let me just also put that in context. First of all, Japan's the number one investor in the United States for the last 4 years. They employed nearly 1 million Americans. We're the number one investor in Japan, and we have been for the last 4 years. Second fact I put out there is about 6-7 weeks ago, Mitsui Corporation from Japan won a $20 billion contract to build a ship crane factory here in the United States to replace all the cranes and not have China's cranes in our shipyards, in our ports across the United States. Nothing says trusted ally like that.
So in that case, what difference would it make if Japan owned U.S. steel?
Second is in 2021, when some foreign entities were thinking of buying Toshiba, Japan invoked national security. So the relationship is deeper. The relationship is more complex than a single commercial deal. And the president has said straight up that he's going to have the back of the United States steel workers and other workers. He's a man of his word. And he's also going to say we're going to invest in the alliance, and they're not in conflict with each other. And I think that looking at this relationship, and I started my politics nationally back in 1992 for Bill Clinton, this relationship has never been stronger and more solid foundation than where it is today. And there's more at stake than a singular commercial deal or transaction where the two parties have a different view.
Yeah. But I understand your point, but if the U.S. and Japan are such close allies, then what difference would it make if Japan actually owned U.S. steel?
Well, first of all, Japan would be a Japanese company. Second of all, what I would say to you, Jeff, is that when it comes to steel, given its national security interests, that is what's being invoked and a priority for the United States and clearly stated by the president. It doesn't change the relationship or the economic interests or the confidence both countries have and the companies in both countries have in investing in each other, which is why for 4 consecutive years, Japan's the number one investor in the United States and will continue to be, and creating over 1 million Americans working for Japanese companies.
How is the administration aiming to future-proof some of this work so that these efforts, which you see is so vital to stability in the Indo-Pacific, aren't tied to whomever occupies the Oval Office post-November or post-January?
The way I look at it is that's a yes and a no. And I think on the yes part is you have things like what we're going to do on missile defense technology or what you're going to do on exercises and shared security arrangements that go into the kind of the bones and the DNA of the institutions and the relationship. But we should be very clear. President Biden believes that allies and alliances make America safer and stronger. That also then requires not kind of hitting an equilibrium, but constantly investing in it. And the reason President Marcos is coming here and the reason the Japanese Prime Minister has agreed to a first ever historic is because they trust America. And if we think that we're going to accomplish anything in the Indo-Pacific solo, we don't understand. That is a different view from the strategy we've had, the different view that isolating China rather than China's being able to isolate a Philippines or a Japan. And so it's not an equilibrium. This has some value that will go past any one administration because it's in our strategic interest. But it also requires a commitment by a president who believes fundamentally that the strategic value of allies and alliances in the safety and security, not only of the United States, but the values that we have and the interests that we want to see advanced.
That is the U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel. Thanks for your time this evening. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah.
The kids' network Nickelodeon helped shape pop culture for decades. But a new docuseries, Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, is exposing the toxic culture behind some of the most iconic children's shows of the 90s and 2000s. As young viewers flock to the channel for beloved programs like The Amanda Show and All That, sexual abuse and harassment were rampant behind the scenes. Here's a quick look.
A lot of these kids in the entertainment industry are vulnerable. The power balance between a child and an adult is so striking already. And then on top of it, you add that it's an employment situation. These are 8 to 15-year-olds, and they are often responsible for the entire economic success of their families. What are they going to do if they get in trouble? What if all of this goes away because they complained? And so you spend your time working, hoping that people don't poke the soft spots on your body and in your brain.
Quiet on Set directors Emma Schwartz and Mary Robertson join me now. Welcome to you both. Emma, start us off here. Your docuseries includes allegations of sexual assault, of pervasive harassment, the overt sexualization of children on these sets. How did you first hear about these allegations, and how hard was it to get people to talk about it?
You know, we first started looking into this because a number of years ago, we saw clips online, clips of, from these shows where you could see the actors who were very sexualized, clips like Ariana Grande massaging a potato online. And we began to ask questions about what was happening behind the scenes. Fast forward, there was Jeanette McCurdy came out with a memoir about her experience growing up on these sets. Kate Taylor at Business Insider wrote an article beginning to sort of delve deeper into what was happening behind the scenes, and we decided to dive even further. It was very difficult to get people to speak, but, you know, we reached out to many, many people, and I think those that participated felt that, you know, they had been holding a lot of secrets, a lot of trauma, a lot of darkness, and that by sharing their experience, that hopefully others would not have to walk down the same path as they had.
Mary, why was this a story that you think a larger American audience needed to know about?
When we were first looking at those clips that Emma references, in which you see young teens in situations that are arguably sexual in nature, arguably evocative of pornography, we also saw questions swirling on social media platforms from many adults who were once, children watching these shows. And these now adults said, how could it be that this material was made? Was I watching a lot of content that was in fact sexualized, but because I was a kid, the jokes went over my head and I didn't know it? And if this arguably sexual content had been created on these sets, who said yes to the creation of this material? Who said no to the creation of this material? And if this material exists, what might it suggest about what inappropriate to illegal behavior was happening behind the scenes? Those feel like meaningful questions to us because they pertain to working conditions for children, and we all have a responsibility to protect minors. And because the content that was created on these sets was ultimately consumed by generations of children, impressionable young minds, and it shaped their sense of normal, their understanding of what is appropriate behavior.
Emma, the man who created many of these shows is someone named Dan Schneider. The New York Times once called him the Norman Lear of children's television. And you document a number of instances in which he really sexualized shows and themes in the show. He, since your docuseries came out, posted an apology of sorts. He's saying that he watched the series. He said it was difficult to watch. He regrets his behavior. He owes people an apology. What do you make of his response?
You know, in the process of putting together our documentary, we reached out to Dan to ask if he would participate and sit down for an interview. He declined to participate on camera, so we sent him, you know, a series of questions and incorporated those written responses into the documentary. As you'll see in the episode 5 that came out on Sunday, a number of the participants felt that Dan's response video was insincere and raised questions about, you know, why it happened just now, after many people had raised questions for a long period of time.
There's also, Mary, the story of this former dialogue coach at Nickelodeon named Brian Peck. He was convicted of sexually abusing a minor in 2004, and we learned through your work that that was actually child star Drake Bell, who comes forward. We also learned there's a number of powerful Hollywood figures who came forward on behalf of Mr. Peck, offering letters of character support for him. What should we make of that?
You mentioned these letters of support that were written by many Hollywood insiders on behalf of convicted child sex offender Brian Peck. And throughout the course of our reporting, our company petitioned the court to unseal these letters, which had been sealed for decades. And after arguing before the judge, he ultimately agreed to unseal these letters. We now do have these letters in the public record, and they raise many questions. And many of those questions remain for us, questions around what information the letter writers had at the time of writing them, who may have asked them to write the letters, if any pressure was exerted, and what the nature of that pressure may have been.
Emma, there's also the bigger question here of the idea that these men weren't working in a vacuum, right? And you wonder, for a system that is built around children, for children, how was this kind of abuse and assault of women, of children, allowed to continue?
You know, there's a lot of layers to the abuses that people experience. Some of it, and not everyone saw all of the different kinds of abuses, right? So you have the adult women that we hear from, Jenny and Christy, who endured a lot of what they say is, you know, sexual harassment and other forms of abuse inside the writer's room. But if you were a child on set, you might not have seen or even known what was happening behind those closed doors. Likewise, some of these child sex offenders like Jason Handy and Brian Peck, they often met their people on the sets, but some of the actual abuses occurred outside of the sets themselves, because there was a closeness and a relationship that formed in what people often described as sort of families on these sets, but they were families with a lot of dysfunction beneath them.
Mary, what has been Nickelodeon's response to all of this? And is there any kind of accountability here?
We offered Nickelodeon an opportunity to send a representative, you know, who would appear on camera in the project. We also included written questions. We also sent them written questions and include their responses in the project. What we're hearing right now, amongst many of those who've watched the film, is a call for industry-wide reform. It has been noted by some that at the moment there's a real absence of federal legislation that could or would protect children working in entertainment. At the moment, there's merely a patchwork system of state laws in place.
Well, all episodes of this docuseries, Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, are available to stream on Max. Directors Emma Schwartz and Mary Robertson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
In the summer of 2022, historic flooding in eastern Kentucky washed away homes and entire communities, claiming more than 40 lives. It also devastated an important cultural hub for the larger region, Apple Shop, home to a large archive of Appalachian history and culture. Jeffrey Brown first brought us Apple Shop's story back in 2018. He recently returned for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Oh, boy. Not like what I remember.
A lot different.
It's a center for cultural preservation now struggling to preserve itself, Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Operations director Roger May recalls the mess of water and mud he found when he first entered after the floods.
It was hard to reconcile what I was seeing with what I was supposed to be seeing.
For most of Apple Shop's 55-year history, this building teemed with the vibrant sights, sounds, and stories of Appalachia. First through filmmaking, expanding to the renowned roadside theater, a radio station, and music classes, all while building an ever-growing, one-of-a-kind archive that documented everything from music to mining. The central idea, to allow the people of this region to tell their own stories, the good as well as the hardships.
I didn't know that you could do journalism in your own community. I didn't know you could tell a story in your small town.
Willa Johnson runs the youth media program at Apple Shop, the same program that first brought her in the door as a 21-year-old aspiring filmmaker.
It was a life-changing moment for me.
Like everyone here, she says she'd experienced flooding, but nothing like what happened in July of 2022.
When we were flooded, it took out the bridge to our community. And so we didn't have cell phone, we didn't have internet, we didn't have water, we didn't have a way out. I just kept thinking, man, I hope they realize why I'm not at work. I didn't even know Apple Shop was underwater. Seeing it underwater was like seeing such a pivotal place, like a home place, being lost.
One response, do what they've always done, filmmaker Oakley Fugit.
After this happened, your instinct as a filmmaker was, we have to document this?
There was a period we had to make sure, you know, everyone was okay, but when we all got together, we were like, we need to tell this story. This is our community. Apple Shop has been documenting it for years.
Fugit was part of a team that produced All Is Not Lost, documenting the toll the flood took on their community.
You could see the water, I mean, it washed houses away.
So why'd you call it All Is Not Lost? Because a lot was lost.
Yeah, but from that came like the community itself reaching out, like strangers just checking in. We have our community and we can build back.
But building back hasn't been easy. Apple Shop, which always relied on a mix of funding sources like grants and private donors, has been forced to ramp up its fundraising efforts since the flood.
The high water mark in here was almost up to my shoulder. So everything in here into our theater, our radio broadcast booth, everything was underwater.
The building is now quite literally a shell of its former self. Its location in the floodplain means Apple Shop will need to find a new home.
WNT, yeah, that's right. The old-time giant in the mountains.
The radio station operates out of an RV parked outside. Theater productions are on pause, and the staff relocated to a temporary office 14 miles away.
This is the archive, so this is the door to the archive back there now.
Most concerning, even irreplaceable, is the film, video, and audio archive.
We consider it all valuable.
On our last visit, we'd seen shelves filled to the ceiling. Now a dark, mostly empty vault.
What was damaged?
Well, everything, reel-to-reel films, audio, photo negatives, everyone's a story. Everyone meant enough to someone at the time to say, hey, I need to record this moment. Well, this is some type of Apple Shop event, concert, looks like. The flood left its own filter. It's just a whole treasure trove of Appalachian culture that was knocked around and inundated with flood water and mud. Some of these film canisters were found miles downstream.
We spend a lot of time talking about how climate change could impact our future. We spend less time hearing about or thinking about how climate change is impacting our past.
For Jennifer Gramado of data management company Iron Mountain, what happened at Apple Shop is part of a much larger problem. Extreme weather events like the so-called thousand-year flood that hit Kentucky are becoming more frequent, threatening numerous heritage sites all over the world.
All of those things aren't just impacting our land and our ability to thrive tomorrow. They're impacting our memories. They're impacting these really important sites that help us connect with prior generations.
3165.
And if we didn't step in to help Apple Shop, there was a real risk that that would be lost forever.
Since last spring, Iron Mountain has housed more than 9,000 recordings from Apple Shop's collection in its cold storage facility free of charge to prevent further degradation. They also developed a cleaning process, so far tested on a handful of videotapes. Including this unedited interview from the famed documentary Stranger with a Camera, about a Canadian filmmaker killed by a property owner while filming in Kentucky in 1967.
And he turned and said, what are you doing? And I looked at him and I saw blood spurting out of this side of the chest.
What do you think when you see this, when this came back from Iron Mountain?
Was just emotionally overwhelmed. It brought tears to my eyes, you know, to see this preserved and kept. It's such important work.
In fact, says May, there is a potential silver lining if more of this material can be preserved and digitized for the first time.
We had a vault and this archive full of material, but we didn't know what was on those reels or on those negatives, you know, and now as we begin to get those digitized and they're coming back to us, some of this material we're seeing for the very first time.
The effort to save the archive revived not only important cultural gems, but also significant personal histories.
Our notebooks.
A friend came upon a box containing Willa Johnson's notes and material from her very first student film.
I said, "How did that survive?" And he said, "It was on a higher shelf." And then I cried because I was like, much more important things should have been on that higher shelf.
A to-do list.
Including Owen Finish.
That's pretty important.
It was just amazing to see and felt so good to see that survive everything.
What else will survive? And what of the organization itself? Roger May looks to the long history of this region.
I'm confident that we'll figure out how to adapt, just like folks in communities like this have for generations, you know, through natural disasters, through the boom and bust of the coal industry. We've figured out ways to stay and to adapt.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Britain's King Charles was presented with the new banknotes of his reign today. The king, who's being treated for an undisclosed cancer, received the notes bearing his portrait at a brief ceremony at Buckingham Palace. Royal editor Chris Shipp of Independent Television News reports from London.
The Bank of England governor does many things.
Andrew Bailey.
But rarely does the holder of the post get to present a monarch with a new set of banknotes bearing his or her face. From the 5th of June, this will be the new £5 note and new tenner, and this the new £20 and £50 notes, perhaps one of the most visible changes of the new reign of King Charles.
The portrait was taken from a photograph that was given to us by the royal household, and we used the photograph to create an engraving, which is turned then into the image you see on the banknotes today.
We have come to present you with your banknotes.
And the monarch always gets the very first ones. Look at the serial number, 000001. And this is the first time the bank has ever changed the sovereign on the front.
The Queen was the first sovereign to be on the banknotes.
This is what's so surprising.
Yeah.
Surprising because Bank of England notes did not feature the monarch until 1960, when Queen Elizabeth became the first to appear on the new £1 note. And of course, the late Queen would be the face of Bank of England notes for the next 64 years. She saw them being printed for herself in 1981 at the bank's printing works in Essex.
I'm sorry, it's a bit delayed.
The King apologised for the delay in receiving the notes caused by his cancer treatment. But today, the phrase "cash is king" felt more than appropriate for this particular moment.
And join us back here tomorrow night as Judy Woodruff travels to Oregon for a look at the growing political divide between rural and urban areas in the U.S. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for joining us and have a good evening.